This is the Oanda Podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
This is the Oanda Market Insights Podcast with me, Johnny Hart. Each week, we review the week's business and market news with Oanda Senior Market Analyst Craig Earlham in London and Ed Moyer in New York. So the FTSE closed 65 points lower today to 5,415. So that's about 100 points down on the week. So after last week's extreme turbulence, by recent standards, markets have been a bit calmer this time around. Why do you think that is, Ed?
I think right now we're taking a look at the general market behavior, and the panic selling has pretty much ended. We saw that the fiscal and monetary response all across the world really alleviated some of the initial concerns that we were going to see, not just a depression-like instance, but also a structural damage to the financial system. So there's been a lot of optimism starting to grow that we're probably going to see easy money flowing into these markets and provide some short-term relief for risky assets. But right now, it's still all about the coronavirus and its spread. And there's still growing concern that it is intensifying. New York had its significant rise and its deadliest day in surges. And there's growing concern that the rest of the country is going to see similar results because the U.S. did not really have a strong mitigation effort put in place. There's lots of market drivers right now, but I think right now the volatility has definitely eased up. But we're starting to see markets try to price in exactly, you know, how long will this economic slump last? And no one can calculate that until we know the lifehood of this virus.
Craig, do you think markets are still a bit in denial? Because when you look at the awful mortality figures coming out of the United States, and of course over here in the United Kingdom, not quite as bad exponentially as they seem to be in the US, but we are not even close to even the beginning of the end of this. I find it astonishing that markets are, I wouldn't say positive or optimistic, but certainly not as turbulent as you might expect under the circumstances at this stage.
I think we have to remember a few things. One is there is always a FOMO element in the markets. People are afraid that they've missed out on picking the bottom, and so they're always looking to buy. There's always this desire to try and buy the correct dip. We saw it earlier on with China when we started to see deceleration there, and there was this kind of hope that this was not going to spread outside the borders of China, which we discussed at the time was a ludicrous assumption. And I feel like what we're seeing now is not necessarily similar, but it's the same idea. The big difference is that we are trading in heavily, heavily discounted markets at this point. So there is reason for people to maybe see value, even if the market is going to dip a little bit further. We are still seeing an acceleration in cases across the, most of the Western world, though, and that is the major concerning point for me. And that's why I'm of the opinion that we haven't yet bottomed. But people getting in at these levels aren't necessarily saying that the market's bottomed. All they're saying is that there is value. And there is value. I think most people agree that markets are going to be much higher than where they are now in a year's time. So if you're a long-term investor, this market still represents value. And the other thing that we have is the fact that the volatility, the wild, wild volatility, which encapsulated the markets throughout the latter part of February and the early part of March, has eased up somewhat. So we're still seeing, we saw 6% decline last Friday, which now doesn't seem extraordinary when previously it would have. But that was a massive markdown compared to where we were previously. And then throughout this week, it's been less extreme. Maybe people have seen how we had the three winning days last week, the biggest three-day gain in the Dow since 1933. Monday's open wasn't too bad, and we saw a nice bounce back. And while Trump's warning midweek was severe and it was a huge change in tone, I think there is also an element of investors looking at the situation right now and going, I think the panic's passed, and that's a good thing. The markets can still go down, but it's the panic which can cost you so much more money. The fact that there's a belief growing that the panic has passed is going to start to tempt people back in.
Okay, we've had the latest jobs figures out today, Ed, for the United States non-farm payroll day, of course. And, well, no surprise, really. The jobs growth of the last decade or so has certainly come to an abrupt halt in March, employers shedding just over 700,000 jobs amid the coronavirus outbreak. I suspect that those figures are very out of date because these figures are taken a little bit earlier in the month, aren't they? Unemployment rate rose to 4.4%. That's the biggest one-month jump since 1975. But we have a long, long way to go, don't we, as far as unemployment is concerned, and it's going to get much, much worse.
Very much so. And I think, as you highlighted, this data was pretty much backward-looking. I think none of the government-mandated shutdowns that were, you know, put firmly across the country are not being reflected by these numbers. But it shows you that businesses were concerned. We did see that the non-farm payroll really kind of surprised people and just how severe the drop was. And it's supposed to get even worse next month. And I think you're probably going to see investors really just focus on those jobless claims numbers, because right now, 10 million Americans over the past 2 weeks have filed unemployment claims. And if we're starting to see the impact start to spread across the country, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't expect that to possibly double. So I think you're probably going to see markets remain very concerned that you're going to see some permanent damage to the economy. Why are we not seeing the stock market yet sell off? I think there's some optimism that the government's ability to implement a broad-based support, whether it's the small business program, whether it's helicopter money and giving individuals cash, it's helping. But I think until we can really understand the full duration of this shutdown to the U.S. economy, we're going to see businesses not be able to keep people on staff, and that's going to really probably be the main catalyst when we start to see things fall apart, and that might kind of make, you know, last week a bear market rally.
Our Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced some extraordinary measures to try and help businesses and save jobs. How do those measures in the UK compare to what you just alluded to in the United States? Do you think they've gone far enough in the US?
They've exceeded expectations, and not just the manner of the response, but in the timeliness. There's only so much government can do. I mean, the economy is closed right now. You're probably going to see it close well beyond April. May is pretty much, I think, a given. And the question is it going to be June, July, August? And there's going to be a lack of a potential response. I think they're running out of arsenal right now to really deliver another key round of stimulus. So the investors are going to go skeptical as far as how much government and central banks can do.
I want to talk about the oil price, guys. Big recovery today from Brent crude, up nearly 10% as we stand at the moment to just below $33 a barrel. And WTI is up as well. Of course, this is on the back of those talks between Russia and Saudi Arabia as regards to the reduction of supply. But that's not a done deal yet, is it, Craig?
No, so there's going to be an emergency meeting on Monday of OPEC Plus and others. The US hasn't confirmed that it's going to be taking part, but I think it's pretty likely there is going to be someone from the US side there, and there's going to be a lot of discussions happening now over the weekend. So the situation we have now is that Russia refused to be part of any cuts at the start of March, and the speculation would suggest that that was a lot to do with the fact that they were effectively growing tired of seeing their market share decline while the US shale industry prospered. And they saw this as an opportunity to say, we can afford oil at these levels and we now want to protect our own market share. We just can't continue cutting all the time and watching the US benefit as a result. And then a lot changed. They said themselves, the reason why they're interesting come back to the table is because a lot has changed since that last meeting. But that doesn't mean that their view on the US has necessarily changed. So if we're looking at a situation with the Russians and the Saudis and the rest of OPEC and other non-OPEC nations talking about cuts again as they were a month ago, I'm not actually convinced we do see a massive cut. I think as far as the Russians are concerned, the US needs to be involved and so do others. This needs to be kind of a global oil production cut rather than an OPEC plus, almost like an OPEC plus, 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 if you will. I'm not sure if this has ever happened before, but this is a huge move if this is what we're going to see. Because the difficulty we have with the US is the fact they're all private producers. So what Trump is going to have to do, rather than Mohammed bin Salman, for example, where he can just order them to reduce production. Trump is going to have conversations with all the big oil producers there and ask them to each agree to their own production cuts and coordinate it that way. Now, I'm not saying that can't happen. I think it can happen. And I'd say at this moment in time, I'd say it probably will. But if he can't convince them to do so, then I don't think the Russians are going to be on board. So I think this all hangs on Trump's ability to persuade the US shale industry to cut back. What he has in his favour is the fact that this week, I think they're called Whiting Petroleum, they applied for Section 11, I think, administration. So basically, they're on the verge of going bust. They need to restructure the business. And I think there's going to be plenty more behind them who are going to follow. This is a shale industry that's heavily indebted. So there may be a number of players within that industry who are willing to cooperate in order to try and stabilise oil prices more towards $40, $50 a barrel so that many more of these firms can survive. But it's going to be a really busy weekend if you are Trump and the rest of his administration. And then everyone is going to be watching that Monday meeting, that Monday conference call very, very closely.
And as you said, I can't remember this sort of coalition amongst the oil producers ever happening. This is a one-off, surely, is it not, Ed?
Pretty much. And I think right now you have to take a look at why is this happening. And all of the major oil producing countries are looking at their global storage capacities, and tankers are being filled. There's concern that if these production levels were to remain in place, we would see no more room for storing oil around May. The Russians are pretty much forced to deliver some production cuts and to kind of keep this optimism going, because if they didn't act, Russia would basically be forced to stop production. And the problem is that if you take a look at who has offshore, onshore drilling, Russia has a lot of their oil on old Soviet fields that has to travel through thousands of miles of pipelines. So the risk for Russia is that they would have to kind of cut production. But unfortunately, when you have tight reservoirs, they're going to get shut down. They're not going to come back online. So Russia is really in a position where they're going to have to slow down their production, and they might as well have the rest of the world deliver production cuts. And you're going to see the U.S. cooperate, Brazil, Canada. This is going to be, you know, a one-off event, but it's something that you're going to see that everyone is going to be on the same page. So, you know, typically Russia's the one that kind of derails these OPEC Plus meetings, but I would be extremely surprised if that were the case on Monday. And right now, some of the early reports are that, well, the U.S. can't officially join a cartel and really say, give hard commitments. The independent oil producers are saying they're going to voluntarily cut output. So I think right now there is a tremendous amount of upside as far as optimism goes, that you're going to see some type of arrangement. But in the end, these if it's 10, 15 million barrel of cuts that are agreed upon, that's still not going to make up for the demand devastation that we're seeing with much of the global economy come to a halt. So you're probably going to see this as an event that might provide a big move higher, but it's still in the short term. In the next couple of months, you're probably going to see lower oil prices kind of remain the theme, because we're not going to see much more optimism in place until we see a return of travel and trade. And right now, it looks like these social distancing measures are not going to go away anytime soon in the U.S. and in Europe, and that's really going to derail a lot of use for crude. So I think you're going to probably see low oil in the short term. But right now, this is a very positive risk on story that, you know, higher oil prices has helped the stock market. So if we didn't have this surge in oil prices, we'd probably see the S&P and the FTSE 100 be down even much further from these levels. So definitely a story to watch, but I think you're going to see something reached upon early next week.
Just to add to what Ed said as well, the other factor that we have to really think about here is whether any production cut, which they do agree, is going to be enough. Trump, in his tweet, said that it was going to be at least 10 million barrels a day that was going to be cut, which sounds like a lot when global oil production at its peak was just shy of 100 million barrels. But when you're seeing that even some of the most conservative estimates are suggesting that we're seeing a 15 million barrel a day shortfall at this moment in time in terms of demand, that doesn't even make up for more than two-thirds of that, let alone if the actual shortfall is more than 15 million barrels a day. It's going to be really difficult to kind of shore up these markets and hit that $50 a barrel level that I'm sure many of these producers would actually like to see. So I think there's still a number of factors at play, and I think there's still a lot of negotiations to be had, because while this is a promising step and it's probably going to stop us seeing $10 a barrel, if anyone's hoping that this is going to deliver $40 or $50, I think that may be a bit of a stretch, because these are very unusual circumstances. And as Ed's already alluded to, this is not a situation that the market can naturally correct itself. Under ordinary circumstances, when oil becomes this cheap, demand just picks up. But demand isn't picking up because many of the airlines that use fuel are grounded. Many people who use their cars are staying indoors. Many businesses who use their trucks and lorries are not operating. So this is not a normal supply-demand scenario. So if OPEC plus want to actually have any real impact on this market and get these oil prices back to sustainable levels, they're going to have to come at us with a much bigger cut than just 10 million barrels.
And looking at the currency markets, guys, the dollar is still pretty strong. Is that because it's sort of the global currency of choice, Ed? And no matter what happens in the United States, despite these awful numbers of deaths over the last few weeks in New York particularly, people still go towards the dollar?
Pretty much so. The dollar is still king. We're going to see it be the preferred safe haven. When we take a look at just where investors are going, dollar is number one. And it's, a lot of that is because treasury demand is firmly in place. I think right now, when you take a look at yields, 10-year yield on the U.S. Treasuries is just below 60 basis points. There's a lot of optimism that, you know, the dollar is going to still remain fairly supported here. But eventually you're going to start to see, when we see the light at the end of this coronavirus pandemic tunnel, you're going to see all of these measures done by the Fed really start to weigh on it. So I think you're going to have currency volatility is here to stay, and you're probably going to see the dollar eventually in the latter part of the year just significantly weaken if the virus is under control. So I think you're going to have volatility remain pretty elevated here. But right now, you know, especially this week, we've seen the dollar consistently strong.
Yeah, I think I agree with much of what Ed's just said. And I think the only other thing as well, probably to add to this, apart from the safe haven elements of the US dollar, which has been clear if you just look at a dollar index chart, is the dollar funding side of things as well. I have heard it, and it suggested that the Fed's efforts to provide plenty of dollar liquidity around the world. We've got to remember in all of this, the Fed is the US central bank, but it's effectively the world's central bank as well. And this kind of shortfall in dollar funding may be one of the things which is driving up demand so much and maybe supporting the dollar as much as it is. This is not necessarily my area of expertise, so take that maybe with a pinch of salt. But if that is one of the things, this kind of potential shortfall or perceived shortfall is one of the things that's driving up demand for the US dollar, then that's potentially something that we should maybe keep an eye on in the coming weeks.
Okay, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Was the OANDA podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.